on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And I hope you're having a very happy and healthy week. And I'm going to start again with the usual news roundup and then go on to some more subjects in depth. And this week we'll be thinking, obviously, a little bit about the virus. Can't escape it, can we? But also the best routine for you. What times are best to do what things during your day to improve your health and improve your life? Right. Starting off with a news roundup. What's the best diet for keeping your heart healthy? Is it a vegetarian diet or a Mediterranean diet? Well, according to research, either approach will reduce your chances of heart disease and stroke. But the real key is to eat a healthy diet with plenty of vegetables, fruits and beans, keeping a check on the amount you eat, and of course avoiding processed foods. Both diets had positive effects after just 3 months, with similar weight loss and a reduction of markers in the blood linked to heart disease. Researchers from the University of Florence tested both diets on a group of 107 healthy but overweight people ranging from 18 to 75 years old. The vegetarian diet included eggs and dairy, and the Mediterranean allowed poultry, fish and some red meat. Participants were randomly assigned to follow one of the diets for 3 months and then switched to the other diet for another 3 months. Weight loss was similar on both diets, an average of 1.4 kilograms of body fat and 1.8 kilograms of overall body weight. Blood markers of heart disease fell after both diets. Changes in markers of oxidative stress and inflammation were similar between the groups, but the vegetarian diet led to a greater drop in LDL cholesterol, while the Mediterranean diet had a bigger effect on triglycerides. And the world of dieting as well, there's another split there between the low fat and the low carbs camps, but both can help you lose similar amounts of weight, a new study has concluded. But the real key is what you eat. Cut out sugars and refined flours and instead eat as many vegetables as possible, say researchers from Stanford University School of Medicine. They tested the two diets on a group of 609 men and women between 18 and 50 years old who followed either approach for a year. But in both groups, the participants were instructed in how to choose healthy options. A fizzy drink might be low fat, but it's not healthy. And an avocado is a healthier low carb option than lard, said research team leader Christopher Garn. I didn't even think you could get lard these days. It's a very old fashioned thing, isn't it? And at the end of the trial, average weight loss in both groups was 5.9 kilograms, although there was enormous variation among the individuals. Some lost over 25 kilograms, but others gained as much as 9 kilograms. Those who lost the most weight had changed their relationship to food and were more thoughtful about what they ate. So just eat smarter rather than eating less, I think, is the key here. And apparently chemicals in household cleaning products are so dangerous that the lung damage they cause has been likened to smoking 20 cigarettes a day. Breathing in the chemicals every day can cause substantial damage to the lungs, leading to shortness of breath and asthma, say researchers at the University of Bergen in Norway. Women who use the products regularly, either as professional cleaners or for cleaning their homes, have seriously impaired lung capacity compared to what would be expected in someone who smoked 20 cigarettes a day for 20 years. The researchers monitored the lung health of just over 6,000 people, some of whom were professional cleaners who use cleaning products every day in offices and homes for 20 years. And the researchers said it wasn't surprising to see such a high level of lung damage when you think of inhaling small particles from cleaning agents that are meant for cleaning the floor. Somewhat surprisingly, the same effect was not seen in men, but this may be down to societal trends limiting the power of the statistics. Very few women didn't do regular cleaning at home, while few men were employed as cleaners. So, yeah. Many of their cleaning products aren't even necessary and could easily be replaced by non-toxic alternatives such as microfiber cloths, and even plain water as well will do the job. And the humble daffodil could play a part in fighting cancer. It's a remedy that's been used in folk medicine for centuries. And now medical researchers are beginning to agree a compound from the flower activates cancer-fighting properties in our cells that starve the tumours and stop their growth. Researchers in the Free University of Brussels and the University of Strasbourg have discovered that the compound, an alkaloid known as hemanthamine, interferes with the production of proteins that cancer cells synthesize in order to grow and develop. As the researchers say, their research is the first to provide a molecular explanation for the tumour-fighting qualities of the daffodil. Hemanthamine is the latest molecule to be extracted from plants for their therapeutic use. Morphine, quinine and ephedrine to treat asthma all originate from flowers. But daffodils do contain toxic compounds, so they shouldn't just be eaten on their own. They do have to be processed. And people suffering from chronic depression are low in arginine, an amino acid found in turkey, chicken, soybeans, peanuts and dairy, a new study has discovered. But it remains to be established whether arginine supplements could help reverse depression, say researchers on the University of Eastern Finland. They measured levels of three amino acids, arginine, citrulline and ornithine, in 99 people diagnosed with major depressive disorder and compared them to samples from 253 others who weren't depressed. Arginine levels were lower in the depressed group, and antidepressants and antipsychotics routinely prescribed for depression didn't help increase them. The researchers aren't sure what the link is between depression and the amino acid, but they think that inflammation, which depletes arginine, might be involved. This could have a knock-on effect that makes the depression worse, as low levels of arginine reduce the production of nitric oxide, which is needed to keep the nervous system and circulation working properly. What surprised researchers was that levels improved only slightly, if at all, in people who have recovered from depression. Arginine can be converted to nitric oxide in the body, which is a critical signalling molecule involved in relaxing the blood vessels, communication between brain cells and immune system defence against bacterial invaders. And apparently, holding the hand of a significant other can dramatically reduce any physical pain they're experiencing. That's according to a new study. Could be difficult in these times, but hopefully your significant other is somebody that you're in your bubble with. Now, apparently, brains synchronize when we hold hands or empathize with our loved one while they're in pain. And it's this that has a pain relieving effect, say researchers from the University of Colorado at Boulder, the University of Haifa in Israel and the Pasteur Institute in France. And the more our brains sync, the greater the pain relief. It's a phenomenon called interpersonal synchronization. And it happens when people mirror the state of the person they're with, encompassing patterns of breathing, heart rate and brainwaves. Researchers wanted to test the idea when they noticed that in particular one of their wives had their pain decreased when holding hands during childbirth. And so 22 couples were recruited who'd been together for at least a year and put them through several scenarios while they were wearing EEG caps to measure brain electrical signals, sitting nearby but not touching, holding hands or being in separate rooms. Even being in each other's company was enough to start the couple's brain syncing. And this increased when they held hands. But when one of the partners was in pain and there was no hand holding, the brain syncing reduced, as did the synchronization of heart rate and breathing patterns. It appears that pain totally interrupts this interpersonal synchronization between couples, and touch brings it back. Empathy when the partner was feeling pain also improved brain syncing, and the more empathetic the person was, the less pain the other felt. The researchers admit they really don't understand how this is happening or whether similar results will be seen with people who are not a couple. Not much chance of testing that one at the moment, is there? But very interesting, though. Now, apparently mobile phones are safe, but now even the UK's chief medical officer has warned that they can interfere with our body clock, which can lead to heart disease, cancer and diabetes. The blue light from phones and computer screens affects levels of melatonin, the hormone that regulates our sleep cycles. And a simple remedy is to turn off your mobile phone and computers before going to bed at night. Light from mobiles and computers is short wavelength enriched, which means it has a higher concentration of blue light than natural light has. Blue light can damage our eyes and also disturb melatonin levels, and this in turn increases the risk of heart disease, cancer and diabetes. Mobile phones contribute to environmental pollution in the home, and chemicals from shampoo, household cleaners, and furnishings can also add to a toxic atmosphere that can cause disease. As a society, we need to regain a focus on pollution as a threat to human health. Our children are affected by noise pollution from roads near their schools, our homes are washed with light pollution every night, and we're exposed to chemicals in the almost invisible dust in our houses as well. So something really needs to be done about that. Right, we're going to take a little break now after that little roundup, and I'll be back with you after this talking about how you can reorganise your day to make you feel better. Stay tuned for more after this.
Once I was 7 years old, my mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. It was a big, big world, but we thought we were bigger, pushing each other to the limits. We were learning quicker by 11, drinking, burning. Never rich, so we were out to make that steady figure. Once I was 11 years old, my daddy told me, go get yourself a wife or you'll be lonely. Once I was 11 years old. I always had that dream like my daddy before me. So I started writing songs, I started writing stories. Something about that glory just always seemed to bore me, cause only those I really love will ever really know me. Once I was 20 years old, my story got told before the morning sun when life was lonely. Once I was 20 years old. Only see my goals, I don't believe in failure, cause I know the smallest voices, they can make it major. I got my boys with me, at least those in favor, and if we don't meet before I leave, I hope I'll see you later. Once I was 20 years old, my story got told, I was writing about everything I saw before me. Songs have been sold, we've traveled around the world and we're still roaming. Soon we'll be 30 years old. I'm still learning about life, my woman brought children for me, so I can sing them all my songs and I can tell them stories. Most of my boys are with me, some are still out seeking glory, and some I had to leave behind, my brother, I'm still sorry. Soon I'll be 60 years old, my daddy got 61, remember life and then your life becomes a better one. I made a man so happy when I wrote a letter once. I hope my children come and visit once or twice a month. Soon I'll be 60 years old. Will I think the world is cold? Or will I have a lot of children who can bore me? Soon I'll be 60 years old. Yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. Once I was 7 years old.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And yes, your daily routine. Does your morning routine involve reaching for the snooze button before getting up, jumping in the shower, then grabbing a coffee? Is it something like that? It may sound typical, but if so, it could be far from ideal for your health. So, what should we do? During the small hours, while we're fast asleep, the body is busy preparing for the day ahead. Levels of the hormone cortisol rise, which leads to an increase in heart rate and the release of glucose into the bloodstream for an energy boost in alertness. These changes are orchestrated by the body clock, the internal 24-hour clock that controls everything from our sleep pattern to our appetite. By about 7 a.m, both body and brain should be prepared for the day ahead, making it the perfect time to wake up and brush your teeth. Now, getting up and brushing your teeth as soon as you get out of bed in the morning apparently is not exactly ideal. You may have well been taught to brush twice daily after breakfast and before going to bed, but doing so straight after breakfast is not the best time because acidity from food and drink can soften the enamel, which is the hard outer layer that protects teeth from decay. Brushing at this point can wear away the enamel. You could wait half an hour to give the acidic substances time to wash away naturally, but that may not be convenient. So brush before breakfast, and if you want to leave your mouth clean after eating, then chew some sugar-free gum. This will leave your mouth feeling minty fresh and stimulate the production of saliva, which will wash away any food debris and restore the pH in the mouth so it's less acidic. And for breakfast, consider having a sweet treat. Now, it might seem odd, but dietists, that's a combination between dieters and scientists. But anyway, dieters who did just that found it easier to maintain their slimline shape, according to a 2012 study by Tel Aviv University in Israel. Around 200 volunteers were split into two groups and put on a strict low-calorie diet for 4 months. They all consumed the same calories overall, but one group had a dessert-type food, such as chocolate, biscuits or cake, as part of their breakfast, while the others had a low-carb meal. Both groups lost the same amount of weight, but after another 4 months, when they had more freedom over their meal choices, the dessert eaters were still losing weight, while the others put the pounds back on. So having a dessert first thing is thought to lower levels of ghrelin, the hunger hormone, so you feel less hungry throughout the day. That's according to the researchers. Now, it seems to reduce cravings for sugary foods later in the day when the metabolism is slower. Studies also suggest that a sweet treat early on prevents the afternoon dip in the feel-good brain chemical serotonin, which is responsible for cravings for sugary food later in the day. Now, to get the best effect, dieters should have a food that they often crave for dessert as their breakfast. This would probably be something we'd normally consider unhealthy. And good news for chocoholics, chocolate is particularly good at raising serotonin levels because it's rich in the amino acid tryptophan, which is converted to serotonin by the brain. So that's well worth trying, isn't it? But I think Europeans, they eat croissants and things like that for breakfast. So I think it's kind of a thing that has been done. So try eating something a little bit more sweet as a sweet treat for breakfast. Now, our bowel movements are governed by our body clock, and after slowing down overnight, which stops us waking up for the loo, they usually need to be emptied by around 8:30 a.m. Healthy bowel movement frequency can range from 3 times a day, every day, to once a day, 3 times a week. That's according to the charity Guts UK. I didn't even know there was such a charity. My goodness, is it even one for the bowels? But when you've got to go, you've got to go. And this is because holding in stools can lead to water in them being reabsorbed into the body, making the stool harder and leading to constipation. Ensuring you've had breakfast, however small, at the right times will keep you regular. This is because eating first thing stimulates the gastrocolic response, a natural reflex that encourages movement in the bowel. Now, the University of Manchester researchers have said the gastrocolic response is active only in the morning, typically within 3 hours of waking. So if you skip breakfast, you might not get this reflex again that day, which can gradually lead to constipation. And then, tempting as it is to have a coffee as soon as you wake up, scientists suggest waiting for an hour or two. This is because there's an early morning surge in the hormone cortisol to increase alertness. So you get a great buzz from the caffeine in your coffee if you wait a little. And our cortisol level rises slowly from its lowest at midnight to its highest at 9 a.m. So theoretically, our wakefulness is being boosted by cortisol until 9 a.m. So then if you have a cup of coffee, it will have its biggest impact. And morning light is linked to leanness. People who have most of their exposure to daylight before noon have a lower body mass index than those who go outdoors later in the day, regardless of how much they eat or exercise. Now, US researchers have said the effect is due to light's ability to calibrate our body clock, which helps regulate levels of leptin and other appetite hormones, and therefore how hungry we feel. If it's out of sync, we're more likely to eat at the wrong times, which affects how we process sugar and fat and, over time, our weight. Now, if a person doesn't get sufficient light at the appropriate time of day, it could desynchronize their internal body clock, which is known to alter metabolism and lead to weight gain. Since it's difficult to get the required levels of light indoors, it's probably good to go outside before noon, 11:30 a.m. at the latest, although any point in the morning would be okay for 20 to 30 minutes if you can, and to do this most days. Most difficult in the winter, though, isn't it? So when do you drink your coffee? If you have one at 2 p.m., it may only be a few hours since your first coffee, but experts say the one with your lunch should be your last. Now, the Global Council on Brain Health, an independent group of scientists and policy experts, which debated the latest scientific research on sleep, recommends that the over 50s avoid caffeine after lunch. It's good advice, whatever your age, because it takes 6 hours for half of the caffeine in a cup of coffee to clear from the body. A typical cup of coffee contains 100 milligrams of caffeine, and if consumed mid-afternoon, the remaining 50 milligrams will still be enough to disturb sleep come bedtime. Not drinking coffee after 2 p.m. is a safe way to reduce the risk of a bad night's sleep caused by caffeine consumption. Advice which is particularly pertinent as we get older, because the body's processing of caffeine, like many other bodily processes, seems to slow down with age. Tea, however, contains less caffeine, around 70 milligrams per cup, and so can be enjoyed for a few hours longer, until 4 or 5 p.m. without disturbing sleep. And if you're hankering after the taste of coffee, then have a decaf. The best time to take your heart pills is around 4 o'clock. If you're prescribed diuretic tablets for high blood pressure or heart failure, try to have your last one by this time to avoid needing the loo during the night. Diuretic pills increase the amount of salt and water lost by the body, as a build-up in the blood vessels can raise blood pressure, but as a result, they make you urinate more. Patients are advised to take their pill in the morning, and that any second dose is taken by mid-afternoon to avoid extra trips to the loo at night. You start wanting the loo for about half an hour after taking one, and the effect lasts for about 6 hours. Decongestant tablets and liquids for colds and sinusitis should also be avoided after 4 p.m. As well as clearing stuffy noses, these popular over-the-counter medicines can act as a stimulant and keep you awake. Try nasal sprays and drops, which have less of a stimulant effect instead. And afternoon and evening exercise sessions build more muscle, which is important for strength, mobility and balance than exercise at other times of the day, research shows. Doing squats, leg presses and common strength building exercises with weights between 5 and 7 p.m. builds the quadriceps, which are muscles that bend and straighten the knee, more quickly than early morning sessions. A 2009 study from the University of Jyväskylä. I probably haven't said that right at all. Finnish with an Essex accent isn't good, but that's a Finnish university anyway. The team who confirmed the result in a 2016 follow-up study said this is due to body clock-driven fluctuations in levels of steroid hormones, which help build muscle, and in the synthesis of protein, which is the main component of muscle. So all these are interesting things, aren't they, to, you know, kind of reorganise your day around, if possible. I know it's not possible for a lot of us because we work and we have other commitments, but it's interesting to know these things. So maybe even at weekends, if we can organise our days like this, or perhaps, you know, our exercise classes, rather than doing them in the morning, if we're able to do them in the evening between 5 and 7, that would certainly make a little more sense, wouldn't it? And certainly be healthier for our bodies. Anyway, I'm going to continue with the rest of your day after this. We're going to have a little break now, and I'll be back for more.
Community Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, we're talking about how to reorganise your day to get the most out of your day and the most out of your health as well. So we've got up to 6 o'clock in the evening now. So an early evening meal could have benefits ranging from reduced heartburn to a lower risk of cancer. That's according to a study in the American Journal of Gastroenterology in 2005. People who eat dinner within 3 hours of going to bed are 7 times more likely to experience heartburn than those who wait 4 hours before turning in. Heartburn is often worse in bed because it's easier for the acid to flow back up the esophagus when lying down. But also the extra hour may give the food, which stimulates production of the acid, time to leave the stomach. Freed from indigestion, sleep should be sounder. Meanwhile, a 2018 study in the International Journal of Cancer found that those who had supper at least 2 hours before bed were 20% less likely to develop breast or prostate cancer. Now, the mechanism is unclear, although researchers said it may be because eating earlier is more in tune with our body clock. Other disruptions, such as exposure to artificial light at night, are also linked to a higher cancer risk. And then later in the evening, we've got to 7:30 now, there's something magical about meeting friends after dark. That's according to psychologists at the University of Oxford. In a survey that was done in 2017, it says that we'd rather catch up with friends and family at dinner than lunch. Plus, an analysis of telephone data that was done in 2014 revealed that our phone calls get longer the later they are. Our preference for evening socialising harks back to our hunter-gatherer ancestors who bonded in the evenings around the campfire, and it could have health benefits. Meeting after dark is much more exciting, and this in turn makes it easier to maintain friendships, allowing us to reap the health benefits that they provide. Socialising triggers the release of the brain chemical dopamine, which lifts mood and raises levels of endorphins, which are brain chemicals that lower heart rate and make us feel calm and relaxed. Endorphins also tune the immune system, triggering the release of natural killer cells that detect and destroy viruses. And at 9:30 in the evening, have a shower. Jumping into the shower around an hour before bedtime could help you sleep better. The theory is that not only does a warm shower or bath help us relax, it also, surprisingly, given that initially it warms us up, reduces core body temperature, which helps us nod off more quickly and sleep more soundly. A University of Texas analysis concluded that a water temperature of 40 degrees centigrade to 42.4 degrees centigrade produces the best quality slumber, and scheduled one to two hours before going to bed, it can hasten the onset of sleep by 10 minutes. That was reported in the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews. Now, core body temperature drops naturally before we sleep and then drops further during the night before rising again as we wake up. Taking a warm bath or shower is thought to speed up the pre-bed drop in temperature because it brings blood to the surface of the body from where heat can be radiated out. And then at 10 o'clock, we should switch off our phones because we're told that blue light emitted from screens keeps us awake if used in the evenings, as this wavelength of light disrupts our body clocks. But while blue light does affect light receptors in the eye that are a key to setting the body clock, the impact on sleep should be small. That's according to studies done by circadian neuroscience professionals at the University of Oxford. In 2014, a Harvard University study which compared how long people took to fall asleep after reading an e-book or printed book found the difference was just 10 minutes longer after using the e-book, which is biologically meaningless, really. However, late night use of phones, computers and other screens keeps the brain mentally active, which can stop us drifting off. To give the mind time to wind down, you're advised to turn off all electronic devices, including TVs and phones, 30 minutes before bed. And this is an interesting one, actually. Antiperspirant may be more effective when applied before bed. A study of 60 women reported in the journal Dermatologist in 2009 found that those who put on the product at night for 10 days sweated less overall than those who used it in the mornings. Antiperspirant works by clogging pores in the outer layer of skin, reducing the amount of sweat that can reach the surface. Putting it on at night gives it time to set in these pores while we're asleep, allowing it to last for hours upon waking. Bed socks, meanwhile, help us fall asleep more quickly by tricking the body into cooling down. When feet are cold, the body produces heat to warm them up, and this also warms up the body as a whole. Popping on socks removes this need and allows the body temperature to drop, which is necessary to fall asleep. Meanwhile, cotton and linen pyjamas are better than man-made fabrics such as polyester at wicking away sweat, which is also important for temperature regulation. And taken daily by millions of Britons on the advice of their doctors to cut the risk of clots that can cause a heart attack or stroke, low-dose aspirin may be most effective if taken at night. Aspirin prevents clots by making it harder for platelets, which are tiny particles in the blood that make it clot, from clumping together. Platelets are most active in the morning, which is also the peak time for heart attacks. A 2013 study from Leiden University Medical Center in the Netherlands found taking aspirin at bedtime reduced platelet activity more significantly than in the morning, possibly as it gives it time to head off to the morning surge in platelet activity. And using an alarm can improve our sleep, because waking at the same time each day helps reduce daytime tiredness and keeps our body clocks in check. But be realistic about the time you'll get up. If you rely on alarm, then set it for the latest possible moment. The alarm is designed to startle you and will cause spikes in your heart rate and blood pressure, which causes stress and is the wrong way to start the day. It's far better you get additional unbroken sleep than needlessly startle yourself by pressing the snooze button 3 times. Meanwhile, going to bed at 10:30 p.m. gives you time to unwind, nod off, and get the 7 to 8 hours of sleep that most of us need before waking up at 7 a.m. So, yeah, 10:30 p.m. in the evening is probably the best time to go to bed. Now, when is the best time of day to get intimate with your partner? Well, generally, it depends on how old you are, according to a body clock expert. Now, the Open University have worked out the perfect time to be intimate with your partner, whatever your age. Their calculations show that 3 p.m. is the magic moment for 20-somethings. They can experience desire at any time of the day, but tend to be groggy in the morning. So afternoon is the prime time for passion. By the time we get to our 30s, an age-related shift in the body clock means that we wake up slightly earlier than in our 20s. This allows us to make the most of the morning sunlight, which boosts levels of the sex hormone testosterone in both men and women, and makes 8:20 a.m. a good time. Now, sleep quality deteriorates with age, and by middle age, we might want to get more intimate around bedtime to trigger the release of oxytocin, a hormone that promotes rest. So it's suggested that getting intimate at 20 past 10 for those in their 40s and 10 o'clock for those in their 50s who will have woken up earlier. So I'm assuming it's 20 past 10 because you're supposed to be going to sleep at 10:30, 10 minutes. That sounds like a long time, doesn't it? But anyway. Okay, 10 o'clock for those in their 50s. Half an hour. That's great. Now, and in our 60s and beyond, we should be getting up and going to sleep significantly earlier. So schedule your intimacy for around 8 p.m. to provide a soothing surge of oxytocin to help you drift off to sleep. So it's fascinating, isn't it? So that's how we should be planning our day. That's the kind of things that we should be thinking about, sort of rearranging and to get the most out of everything that we do. It's fascinating, isn't it? How our body clocks work, really, and how we respond so differently to different things at different times of the day. Absolutely incredible. I know it's difficult to rearrange your day sometimes, though, isn't it, with work and everything getting in the way, families, etc. But it's worth thinking about, isn't it, and worth bearing in mind how different times of the day can have such a huge effect on things that we just do normally and take for granted. Even taking your pills at a different time of day can make a difference to the way that they affect your body and how you feel. So, Yeah, and that all-important 7 to 8 hours sleep as well obviously goes without saying, doesn't it? We all need that. We all feel so much better when we've had a good night's sleep. Disrupted sleep isn't good for anyone. So, yes, just a few tips there for you. Right, we're going to take another little break now and I'll be back with more good, healthy stuff for you right after this.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And so we've been talking about our daily routines and things like that. Well, part of our daily routines now, it seems, has to include the wearing of a face mask or face covering. So we ought to think about, you know, the implications of that, really. Now, people who have asthma or other lung conditions should not wear a face mask if it makes it difficult for them to breathe. That's according to Asthma UK. And the government is now advising people to wear face coverings if they're out in places where it's difficult to stay at least 2 metres away from others. This is because the coronavirus is a respiratory virus, meaning it infects people when it's breathed in and attaches to cells inside the airways and the lungs. But people who have asthma or illnesses such as chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, or cystic fibrosis may find masks or face coverings make it hard for them to breathe. Experts say people should wear a mask if they comfortably can to protect themselves and others around them, but not risk their own health in the process. In its official guidance, Britain's Cabinet Office now says if you can, wear a face covering in an enclosed space where social distancing isn't possible and where you will come into contact with people you do not normally meet. This is most relevant for short periods indoors in crowded areas, for example on public transport or in some shops. But it adds face coverings shouldn't be used by children under the age of 2 or those who may find it difficult to manage them correctly, for example, primary age children unassisted or those with respiratory conditions. Now, respiratory conditions are illnesses that interfere with someone's breathing, such as asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. Oh, gosh, I should stop saying that, shouldn't I? I can't say it properly. COPD, much easier. Cystic fibrosis, chronic bronchitis, emphysema or lung cancer. Wearing a mask, experts say, can make it harder to draw air into the lungs and make symptoms of these conditions worse. And Asthma UK says for some people with asthma, wearing a face covering might not be easy. It could make it feel harder to breathe. The government has advised that people with respiratory conditions don't need to wear face coverings, so if you're finding it hard, then you shouldn't be wearing one. So, and there is a guide to how to for people to how to make face coverings out of t-shirts to protect themselves from the coronavirus. Now, I'm not sure that the I'm not sure how protective a t-shirt material is, but anyway, the British government urges people to wear face coverings rather than masks, and this lines up with the CDC's advice in the US, which is for people to make their own face covering out of cloth rather than buying special ones. These may include scarves, bandanas, cloths, or it's even published a how-to guide for making a basic mask out of an old t-shirt. Now, the Health Minister, Joe Churchill, said that they're advising people to consider wearing a face covering if they can in enclosed public spaces where social distancing is impossible, for example, on public transport or in shops. This may help prevent you spreading the virus to others. You do not need a clinical mask, which is prioritised for healthcare workers. Instead, of face covering is sufficient, and they're encouraging people to make these at home with items they will already own. Countries around the world now require people to wear masks while in public to stop them spreading the disease. And while the practice was already widespread in East Asia, it's now spread to Western Europe and Germany, Czech Republic, Austria, Slovakia, and last week France have required people to wear them in certain situations by law. In the US, it's not necessary, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advises people to wear a face covering of some sort while in public. Although the scientific consensus is that a mask or face covering will not protect someone from the virus, it may stop them spouting virus-infected droplets into the air for people around them to breathe in. The coronavirus spreads in droplets, which means they piggyback on the water that people breathe out normally, and that causes condensation when you breathe on a window. A cough or sneeze can spread the virus considerably further than just breathing. Now, research on how well various types of masks and face coverings varies, really. But recently, and in light of the pandemic, experts are increasingly leaning towards the notion that something is better than nothing. A University of Oxford study published on this year concluded that surgical masks are just as effective at preventing respiratory infections as N95 masks for doctors, nurses and other healthcare workers. It's too early for there to be reliable data on how well they prevent infection with COVID-19, but the study found the thinner, cheaper masks do work in flu outbreaks. The difference between surgical or face masks and N95 masks lies in the size of particles that can, and more importantly, can't get through the materials. N95 respirators are made of thick, tightly woven and moulded material that fits tightly over the face and can stop 95% of all airborne particles, while surgical masks are thinner, fit more loosely and are more porous. This makes surgical masks much more comfortable to breathe and work in, but less effective at stopping small particles from entering your mouth and nose. And droplets of saliva and mucus from coughs and sneezes are very small, and viral particles themselves are particularly tiny. In fact, they're about 20 times smaller than bacteria. For this reason, a JAMA study published this month still contended that people without symptoms should not wear surgical masks because there is not proof the gear will protect them from infection, although they may keep people who are coughing and sneezing from infecting others. But the Oxford analysis of past studies, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, found that surgical masks were worth wearing and didn't provide statistically less protection than N95 for healthcare workers around flu patients. However, any face mask is only as good as other health and hygiene practices. Experts universally agree that there's simply no replacement for thorough, frequent hand washing for preventing disease transmission. Some think the masks may also help to train people not to touch their faces, while others argue that the unfamiliar garment would just make people do it more, actually raising infection risks. If the CDC does instruct Americans to wear masks, it could create a second issue because hospitals already face shortages of masks and other PPE. So it looks like mask wearing is going to become more commonplace anyway. And they are mandatory, or were mandatory, in shops and supermarkets from the 24th of July, and already have been in Scotland as well. And plus, they need to be worn on public transport and in areas where it's not possible to keep the social distancing rules. Now, as more people will be wearing masks for longer periods of the day, our skincare regimes have come into question. So think about looking after your skin if you're wearing masks for any particular length of time. The sorts of cleansers you should use, how you can protect your noses, the skin from getting sore if there's any kind of chafing going on. So as a nation of people who never had to wear masks as part of our everyday routines, it's understandable that we might have a few problems with our skincare. So you might need to kind of add to your skincare routine. If you're having to wear a mask for a long period of the day, you could add a skin barrier protection cream to your face ahead of putting your mask on for the day, and that will help to reduce irritation and sores from continual applied pressure. And as far as our morning and evening skincare routines go, keeping up with a simple and consistent routine is the best thing you can do for your skin during this time. That includes cleansing with a calming and soothing cleanser. And although retinol is having its moment in the spotlight for its anti-aging properties, it's suggested that it might be worth leaving harsher acids out of your routine for the time being, because these can leave the skin sensitive and more prone to chafing and breakdown when continued pressure is applied. Now, hydration is still seen as a key part of everyday skincare routines, particularly with the virus around. So keeping hydrated, very, very important. It's also the skin's barrier is the outermost layer of the skin. It shields skin from bacteria and irritants. It also seals in moisture and hydration. To ensure the barrier is healthy, it's important to drink plenty of fluid throughout the day. I mean, 2 liters, I guess, is recommended, but if that's not possible, then, you know, just fluid, just liquid. But obviously not anything that's going to be too dehydrating like alcohol. And if you're already suffering from a sore face because of your PPE, there are some things you can do to help recovery. So to help treat any nasty bruising from the mask, ensure that you have a diet rich in vitamin C, as that's essential for collagen production. And collagen encourages the renewal of cells and therefore helps repair wounds on the skin. And in sensitive areas like the bridge of the nose, it might also be worth applying a little bit of gauze as an extra layer of protection for thinner areas of skin too. So do think about protecting your skin in this mask wearing time, and you know, don't let your skin go to pot just because of it. So if you do notice some chafing or some sore areas because of wearing face masks, it really dents the skin sometimes, doesn't it, if you are wearing a mask. So just be careful that you're looking after your skin and not letting it become damaged. So that's brilliant. Okay, so I hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of the show. Some hints and tips for keeping you fit and healthy yet again. So until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.